Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. This is the third part of our look at Alan Klein. And I guess we're wondering, what is the story so far? Well, to bring people up to date, plucky New York City upstart Alan Klein has been playing the longest of long games, and having finally secured a meeting with John and Yoko in January 1969, has managed to breach the Fab Wall to take over their business affairs with Lee and John Eastman on retainer as Apple's attorneys at law, and also Paul McCartney's attorneys in law. But Alan wants see what I did there? But Alan wants all of this to be recognised by a signed contract by all four Beatles, which leads us, when we left off at the end of part two, at the start of May 1969, trying to pursue a certain Paul McCartney. But before we get there, we should probably go somewhere else.
It's what we do best.
Well, it is, because in the last part we kind of talked about how Alan Klein and his amazing work at managing to secure the Beatles' freedom from NEMS for only twice as much as they wanted to buy it for, was also trying to arrange another business deal in the spring of 1969. And this is where we're going to have to talk about the behemoth that is
Northern Songs.
Northern Songs. And, you know, this is Northern Songs could be a whole podcast season on its own.
Can we do a whole podcast season on its own about Northern Songs?
I wouldn't mind.
I'm here for that.
So while Northern Songs is happening, the other question we have to ask ourselves is, you know, Alan Klein is kind of beavering away, and he's not the only business person who's passing in and out the doors of Savile Row.
He's not the only beaver in town.
Well, no, he's perhaps the guy with the biggest attitude and the biggest, what would you say? He's got moxie, Stephen. Moxie. That's the word.
He's got moxie. He's got the New York walk and the New York talk.
Yes, and this is what grabs makes people impressed when he walks into the room. But who are the other potential people who are in the orbit at the time that perhaps could have been playing a role and who are playing a role in some parts?
Yes, so there are other potential candidates. So we're going all the way back to Brian's death in August 1967. So there is a vacancy since August 1967. Clive Epstein has made it clear he's not stepping into that role, and I don't think the Beatles would have him. Stig Wood is, you know, fallen by the wayside. But there are other people still around. So the first person is really a chap called Harry Pinsker. And he was Brian Epstein's accountant from the olden days. And he sat on the board of directors with Apple. And his remit was really just to keep an eye on expenditure and stop the Beatles from overspending. And then John and Yoko appeared nude on the cover of Two Virgins.
And is that right?
He resigned in protest.
Right.
I have to say, I try not to deal with clients, you know, in the nip. Myself, you know.
Can you make it stand up in court? All those old jokes.
He resigned, and then he sort of thought, this is probably not a good idea to have resigned. So he put a junior member of the firm in to carry out a detailed survey of the company books. This is a chap called Stephen Maltz.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't afraid of John and Yoko's particulars.
No. He got an eyeful of the books. And Maltz is interesting, or what he does is interesting, because it really sets the context for what the parlous state of Apple and the financial state of the Beatles. So he spends several weeks on the task, and then he writes a 5-page letter to each of the Beatles saying, "It's not good. It's definitely not good, boys." And so in less than a year, Apple had spent £2 million that had been set aside as part of the sort of tax write-off, because we have to remember...
That's the whole point.
It was a tax write-off. So all of that money has been spent, plus another $400,000, which was the first installment of their payment for sort of selling the Beatles, selling their own services to the company. In addition, each had overdrawn his partnership account. Paul, most heavily, bear in mind, you kind of think this is going to be John and Yoko with all their hot air balloons and everything, but this was slightly earlier. Paul is £66,988 overdrawn, and they have, each of them has an income tax liability of £600,000. So it's not good, Jason. It's not good.
And this chap, Stephen Maltz, who I have to admit is not a name that was on the tip of my tongue, M-A-L-T-Z, if you want to Google the man, what I kind of like about his appearance in the story is that he's literally doing it by the book. He's totally following his remit. He's following the money. He's doing the thing that Klein says he's the best at, which is taking a set of books and going through them forensically and seeing what needs to be done. And we kind of have to assume, well, the Beatles obviously know who he is, but when they get a five-page letter from Stephen Maltz, it's not really telling them. It's telling, speaking truth to power, and they don't really want to hear it.
They really don't want to hear it. And this is something that will become apparent, that they don't want to face up to the situation. But it is a case of speaking truth to power. It's not just a sort of forensic analysis. He actually says, as far as you were aware, you only had to sign a bill and pick up a phone and payment was made. You were never concerned where the money came from or how it was being spent, and were living under the idea that you had millions at your disposal. Each of you has houses and cars. You also have tax cases pending. Your personal finances are in a mess. Apple is in a mess. So this sets the context. I mean, that's pretty judgmental, the way he's, you know, laying that out.
But their accounts obviously weren't in a mess in the Brian era, when there was some kind of oversight. Now, I don't know exactly how the money went from NEMS to the Beatles, but that was NEMS' job, was to take in all the worldwide accounts from tours and record sales and then divvy it out to the Beatles. And, you know, hopefully in such a way that they didn't really have to worry about such fipperies as tax, that somebody else would worry for them.
Yes, I think Brian did the worrying for them. And there is a sense that the actual expenditure would not have become so out of hand on Brian's watch. I think that's the point. You know, once he wasn't there to sort of rein in the extravagances.
And this notion that, as you say, Apple is a tax write-off. So the whole point of Apple is that the Beatles have a huge tax liability and they don't have to pay the tax liability if they take the money that they owe the tax man and invest it in something.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tale as old as time, Stephen.
So, and what do? They just spend all the money in less than a year, plus another $400,000 on top of that.
On the plus side, you know, they had a good time doing it, I'm assuming. It's like the morning after the night before, and you're like, well, you know, you can certainly... It's not a mystery that they spent it.
No.
You know? So, yeah, that's a pretty damning statement. Your personal finances are in a mess. Apple is in a mess. And I'm sure that, you know, from the Fab Four, they stuck their fingers in their ears and went la, 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 and moved on to the next thing. The other person in the room is obviously Neil Aspinall. Why is Neil Aspinall not doing this job?
Well, you tend to forget that Neil was an accountant by trade, or at least by his
training.
His training was as an accountant, but he was effectively acting as a manager in all but name, but he technically still only their roadie. And it is the case that John did say to him, look, would you take this on? You can have the 20%. But he, at that stage, I think just lacked the confidence to take on the job officially. You know, he may have trained as an accountant originally, but he had been acting as a roadie effectively, and he just wasn't prepared to take it on.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure everybody listening here knows who Neil Aspinall is, but he's been there since the start, driving the van from the early days, a school friend of the band, confidant, somebody who all four of them get on with and trust and like. And, yeah, as you say, Lennon says, take the 20%, and he almost is, I think he's guilty, or he feels he's not up to it, or he just doesn't want to do it. And the trade-off is that in later years, he is the man who takes over Apple and makes Anthology happen and all the CD reissues happen and renegotiates with EMI and gets all that money out of Apple computers. He does a phenomenal job when the time comes in many years later.
Yeah, and I think as well as perhaps lacking in confidence, I think one of the other things is he is bound to have realized that what was required was someone to go in there and start firing people, start closing down aspects of it. And we mentioned on one of the earlier episodes, Lord Beeching.
Speaking of closing things down.
Yes, yes. Dr. Beeching, who had basically shut down the railways for the UK government, they approached him. You know, that's a conversation you would like. You'd like to be a fly on the wall for John Lennon talking to Lord Beeching. And John says, Paul had told me, go and see Lord Beeching. So I went. I mean, I'm a good boy, man. And I saw Lord Beeching and he was no help at all. Paul was in America getting Eastman and I was interviewing all these so-called top people and they were animals. Alan is a human being. The same way Brian was a human being. Beeching was basically, again, I think what's happening there is Beeching is saying you need to axe unproductive aspects of the business, get rid of Apple Electronics, Apple Tailoring. Do we need a barber in the basement? Some people are querying the need to have a pantomime horse on staff. You know, it's that kind of thing.
I mean, Lord Beeching, he was, if memory serves, he was an industrial head. He came out of ICI, which is a petrochemical business that was one of the UK's main, you know, global businesses in the 1960s. And the reason why he's remembered in British culture these days is this thing called the Beeching Report, which he put out in the early 60s, which closed down all these kind of end of branch lines in the UK railways, the effects of which are kind of still being felt today. And there was a second Beeching Report, which wasn't enacted. But this isn't a railways podcast, Stephen. But people of a certain age in the UK, you say Lord Beeching and this is true.
And then they went to Sir Joseph Lockwood at EMI and he said, why don't you go and have a word with Lord Poole? Lord Poole being the Queen's financial advisor. And Paul went to see him and supposedly in that conversation, Lord Poole took his tie off to create a relaxed, informal atmosphere. And Sir Joseph Lockwood said Lord Poole offered to sort the Beatles out, and what was more, he offered to do it for nothing, but they just never followed up on it.
Strange.
Oh, Paul.
And so Alan Klein prevails, so to speak.
Yes.
But this is still in that kind of place in time where he hasn't been fully signed up as a manager yet. He's still trying to prove his worth. And one of those jobs then is the whole Apple clean out that he has to, well, he it's kind of done in the guise of cost cutting and efficiency and, you know, that some people have to be gotten rid of, but it's also done as a land grab for power.
Yes, I think it can be seen in both those ways. So, I mean, he is doing what Lord Beeching has recommended, which is just close down the unproductive aspects of your business, the tailoring, the barbering, the TV repairman in the basement who's spending all your money, and just concentrate on what you do best, which is record production and be a record company. And this is really what Klein comes in and does, and he starts firing people. And he's quite explicit. He said the Beatles wanted to be rid of the leeches, but they were embarrassed to fire them, so they asked me to do it. But I think you're right. What he does is he gets rid of people that are close to the Beatles. So he gets rid of the secretaries and he gets rid of, you know, there's a funny story where he gets rid of the people in the kitchen and then nobody can get a cup of tea. But he does get rid of some very senior people who are very close to the Beatles, and because they're getting in his way between him and the Beatles.
Yeah, but when you say he's getting rid of these people because he wants to run a great record company, he gets rid of people who are able to run record companies and people who are able to manage artists and who go on to greater success. People who could have been an asset to an Apple that really wanted to do business.
Yes, there is an element of sacking people for the sake of sacking people. You know, so he begins by sacking 16 members of staff, but that includes Ron Cass, who is the US manager for Apple. He gets rid of Alistair Taylor, who is the general manager, previously being Brian's assistant. You know, Cass gets a very lavish golden handshake, goes off and joins MGM Records in LA. And then there's this weird scenario where Klein suddenly realizes Cass is quite friendly with Paul. I'm not getting on with Paul. I should get Ron Cass back. And then that might curry some favour with Paul, and he can kind of tell Paul what a great guy I am. And he's offering Cass huge amounts of money to come back. and Cass turns him down, and Klein is very persistent. And Cass is Californian. He's this kind of, you know, tanned, athletic guy, and he's a very good tennis player. And he says to Klein, "I'll come back if you can beat me at tennis." And, you know, Klein is this kind of short, tubby, out of condition, New York, pale lawyer. And Klein takes him on. And Cass says he only just managed to beat Klein, that he was absolutely, at one point he thought Klein was going to win because of the sheer determination. And he sort of tells that story, you know, as an indication of just with Klein, if Klein wants something, he's prepared to go all out to get it, you know.
So he Peter Asher is another person who's kind of pulled away. Ron Cass pulls Peter Asher away. Peter Asher brings away such talent as James Taylor. These are all people who would be useful to have in a you know, an independent record label in the early 70s. Ivan Vaughan was developing an Apple school, and that got knocked on the head. What is it with people in schools? I've recently watched this show about the people who set up WeWork. I don't know if you've seen this. And one of the things they did was set up a school. Pure vanity project. Anyway, that loses a ton of money. And as you say, Alistair Taylor is kind of fired as well. And he's almost got this kind of World War II, you know, going down with the team, kind of stiff upper lip. You know, if I'm afraid we've had it, boys. It's kind of the attitude in Apple at that time.
He is quite bitter, and he talks about it's Peter Brown that has to deliver the message that says, you know, "I'm sorry, you're gone. Ron Cass is gone." And he said, "I was shocked, but I was not surprised. You're joking, aren't you?" I gasped as I struggled to come to terms with my life being turned upside down. "No, I'm not," replied Peter sadly. "Alistair, I wanted to tell you myself before one of Klein's people told you. I went back to my office to ring the boys, not to plead for my job back, but just to make sure they knew what was going on. The whole philosophy of Apple was taking care of people, so I felt sure they would want information. I rang each of them, Paul, John, George, Ringo, in that order, and not one of them took my call. I got excuses from embarrassed wives and secretaries. I heard nervous Beatle voices in the background, but not one of my four famous friends came to the phone. And that hurt a hell of a lot more than getting the sack."
Yeah, that's...
So they are acquiescing in this.
Yes.
They're not kind of, I don't want to say not man enough, but you know, they're not prepared to go and face these people down. People like Alistair Taylor, people like Ivan Vaughan that they've known for years and years and years, they're not prepared to do that themselves. And they are all, including Paul, quite happy to let Klein go in and get rid of these people.
But that's okay, in a way. I mean, we could argue about who we got rid of and how we got rid of them, but the notion that the talent shouldn't have to do some of this stuff themselves, I think is reasonable. Now, saner heads would have gotten rid of maybe different people or restructured things in a different way. But, you know, the Beatles can't be getting involved with some of this stuff.
Well, I take that point, but I think what you've got to bear in mind is Apple was all about doing things in a different way.
True.
And one of the big criticisms of Klein is always he brought this ruthless sort of efficiency to what he did, and he was very brutal, and he got rid of people, and he, you know, there's that scene in the Ruttles where people would rather hang themselves than commit suicide than meet Ron the Klein. But actually all of this is happening with the full knowledge and authority of all four of the Beatles. That's the important thing I think we've got to bear in mind here. All four of them, including Paul, you know, they're keeping a distance. They're distancing themselves from what Klein is doing, but they're letting him do it. And he's working without a contract here.
Well, I've no doubt that Paul acquiesced, because, again, we've kind of touched on this once or twice during these episodes. But you look at Paul's business setup now, which was set up by the Eastmans. It's a very efficient business. Like, there's no, what would you say? There's no waste. It's very lean the way Paul's business is set up.
But I think the responsibility for this does not lie with Klein. The responsibility lies with the Beatles. And very often it's characterised as it was Klein doing this.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there wasn't an element of he was picking and choosing, you know, who he was getting rid of, and that obviously it improved his position. But he was basically doing what the Beatles wanted him to do at this point.
Mm. And even the Zappa label was shut down, leaving Barry Miles stuck in New York with Allen Ginsberg. Allen Ginsberg, of course, famous for appearing on the Flaming Pie box set. I think that's what he's most famous for. So this is all happening. So I guess, you know, when around this time, John is writing the line, you know, Peter Brown called to say you can make it OK. There mightn't have been anyone else in the office to ring him at that point. Peter Brown is hanging around on his own, and there's probably an echo, and there's no secretaries, there's no one to make the tea, and that's it, really.
That's it.
These are the dramatis personae, so to speak, that are kind of circulating at this point in time. But as we mentioned at the top, the big ticket item is Northern Songs, because there have been issues arising with Northern Songs that the Beatles want to gain ownership. So in the grand scheme of their professional lives, they are tethered to EMI, NEMS and Northern Songs. And yes, they are the kind of the three legs of the stool that Klein is out to try and renegotiate and manoeuvre and reset in their favour.
Yes, because what happens is, although we're sort of breaking this down into different sort of aspects, you know, the NEMS deal, the staff cutting, all of this is happening at the same time.
Yes. And it's also, we should say, it's happening at the same time as a group who are trying to record records, put out singles, you know, sit on a load of Get Back footage and figure out what to do with it. They're still trying to function as a group, and they're, you know, they are, you know, in the spring of 69, putting out the Get Back single, putting out the Ballad of John Yoko single. There's all that nuts and bolts is happening as well.
It is, and this is one of those periods where I think everybody will be familiar with individual things that happen. Mm. You know, the Bed In and the Northern Songs and Klein and all. But it's putting that all into a timeline and saying how much of that was all happening at once. So in early March of 1969, and bear in mind, you know, how close we are off the back of Get Back. Mm-hmm. Klein has arrived, NEMS is happening, and then suddenly in early March, Northern Songs comes into play because Dick James and his partner, Charles Silver, decide to sell their shares in Northern Songs. Now, this is the point at which we're probably going to have to give them 5 or 10 minutes to go and get a pen, piece of paper, a pencil.
Get some red thread and some drawing pins in order to connect things.
To connect all of this.
Yes.
So by way of background, I'm just going to give you 20, 30 minutes of background on Northern Songs. So Northern Songs was the publishing company that was created in 1963. By Dick James. Dick James appears in Get Back, and
a wonderful moment.
It is a wonderful, wonderful moment, and I think it was at that point that I realised how accurate Barry Cryer's impersonation of Dick Jaws, the music publisher of No Fixed Talent, in the Ruttles, actually was. But we know he was a singer in the past. He sang the theme tune for Robin Hood.
Robin Hood, running through the glen. Thank you.
That it's one? Like having Dick James in the room. And that was produced by George Martin.
Once again,
there you go.
It's all connected.
It's all connected. So anyway, he sets up...
Isn't that the song with an arrow on it?
It is the song with an arrow. That's a fun fact. It was a hit single in 1956, and it has a sound of an arrow in flight. And George Martin actually got an archer to come into Studio 2 and fire arrows past a series of microphones to get the right sound, but realised pretty quickly it didn't work. And in the end, he used the slowed down sound of a ruler being sort of twanged against the desk. We've all done that. Insert sound effect at this moment. And who else shot bows and arrows around the studio?
Well, Paul. Well, yeah, it is Paul. Should say Arrow Through Me on his 1979 magnum opus Back to the Egg, but that's not the truth, is it?
No. Crina Crore. And he went to Harrods and he spent a long time. But, you know, if he'd bothered to ask George Martin, he said, no, you just need to do all that. Just twang a ruler on the desk and it'll be exactly the same. You've completely just derailed
my analysis. Sorry, I've derailed that.
No,
I just knew that was a thing. So anyway.
So it's a private company, and Dick James owns 50% with Charles Silver. John has 20%. Paul has 20%. And Brian Epstein has 10%. And that is the way it is constituted. There's lots of other corporate shenanigans going on in the background with Lenmac Limited, Maclean Inc. in America. And we'll not go into all of that. But this is a private company. It's earning a lot of money. There's a big tax liability in early 1965. And there's a decision taken to float the company on the stock market, which is basically that the company was going to issue more shares and sell those or make those available to the public so you can buy shares in Northern Songs. And the reason for that is UK income tax had a top rate of 83% in the early 1960s, and there was an additional 15% surtax on top earners like the Beatles. But what there wasn't in 1964-65 was capital gains tax. So if you sold an asset and made a gain, you didn't pay tax on that. And capital gains tax only came in the UK in April 1965, so any gain before April 1965 you could take that tax free, whereas as opposed to income.
Right. Okay. I'm paying attention. I'm following. It's pretty revolutionary, or was at the time, or it was kind of new showbiz that a publishing company would go onto the stock exchange. We perhaps take it for granted now, particularly in the 21st century era of these kind of publishing rights companies buying up the Dylan catalogue and the Springsteen catalogue and all the rest, that these things have a financial value or an asset as a package or as a tool of finance. But Northern Songs going on the stock exchange was a unique deal, and very farsighted in a way, even if it was a tax dodge at heart.
Yes. And, there'd been some criticisms and people saying, oh, they could have done other things, or they could have moved offshore, or they could have done this, that, or the other. Brian Epstein was not particularly keen on this, and he sort of absented himself from the process because he wasn't entirely convinced this was going to work out. Northern Song is a very young company at that stage. Usually you would have to be trading for at least 5 years before you would be allowed to do this by the stock exchange authorities. You were saying you were paying attention when I was outlining all of that. I think you're probably paying more attention than the Beatles, because the decision was taken in February 1965 and only John Lennon was present. I mean, you think he'd be the least kind of interested in this. But essentially what they do is they issue 5 million shares, of which 1.25 million were made available to the public. Mm-hmm. And the minimum buy was 200 shares at a time, and they were valued at 39p.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So wait a sec, I should multiply 39p by 2 million, shouldn't I? 39 times 2 million is the valuation of the company. And that is, it only says, what, they only think the company's worth 780 grand?
No, 39p times 5 million.
By 5 million
shares.
Me.
There were 5 million shares issued, of which 1.25 million were made available to the public.
That makes it a valuation of about just under 2 million, that Northern Songs was worth 2 million in 1965. Yes. Gosh, that's a lot of money in 1965.
And bear in mind, the assets on which this valuation are songs written by these two guys from Liverpool that nobody knows. But in 1965, the number of cover versions and the money being generated from cover versions and things like that doesn't really start to kick in until late 65, 66. And then suddenly there's by 1966, there was something like 2,900 cover versions of songs. And so this was not expected to be a hugely successful flotation, and it wasn't particularly successful. Mm-hmm. The shares were put out at that price, and then the share price fell. But then it started to go back up again. And in that sort of interregnum, when the share price fell, various other people connected with the Beatles were buying up the shares. There's a chap called Isherwood who was involved in this, and he was saying, he had some money lying around for clients, and he was investing in this because no one was sure whether Northern Song. So this is going to be a long term. You know, it's easy for us to say now, as you say, in the context of people paying millions for shares, or we know what happened. We know the Beatles are still around 50 years, 60 years later. No one knew if this was going to.
But even at the time, there is like there's a book by Clinton Halen called One for the Money, which is kind of a history of music publishing. Music publishing is still generally new at this point. It's a turn of the 20th century type of business exercise. And, you know, you can get phenomenally very philosophical about it and say, well, why? How can anyone actually own a song? You know, that's how many of the early kind of blues and traditional copyrights were signed up, because, you know, like, you know, similarly to how can you possibly own land? People didn't realize that there was an intrinsic value in some of these songs. And so as a business, publishing is about, you know, 70 years old, I suppose, at that point. You know, it comes on with the recorded song. But most of the money is made from, you know, sheet music sales. And, you know, the Beatles are kind of representing a different type of publishing through cover versions and electronic recordings that, you know, isn't really to do with the early phases of music publishing. So it is a new world. And but if you're farsighted enough, you can kind of see that that's where the money is going to be.
This is it. I mean, we it's sort of famously, it was Paul said, you know, he didn't realize you could own songs whenever they were writing songs.
Yeah.
But this nets Paul and John £94,270 each, tax free, which, you know, I should have done the conversion, but in 1965, that was checks, notes, a lot of money.
Well, the thing I would say is, yeah, there's 5 million shares, 1.25 million go available to the public. That leaves 3.75 million shares. And split up by the percentages, Dick James gets about 930,000, Charles Silver gets 930,000, John and Paul gets 750,000 each. NEMS, as an enterprise, gets 375,000. And we talked in the last episode about the NEMS share of Northern Songs. Mm-hmm. And George and Ringo get 40,000 shares each. And as you say, they get just under £95,000 from that. And that would pay off, for instance, Paul's Cavendish Avenue house, which cost about 72 grand in and around that time. So not an inconsiderable sum of money.
Not an insubstantial. So the remaining shares then are owned largely by financial institutions, but also some private individuals who have snapped up shares. You know, you and I would have been buying some shares in.
Oh, absolutely. And it's maybe worth parking that notion that there's a couple of fun Beetleheads who've gone off and bought themselves 200 shares just for the hell of it. For the crack, you might say, Stephen.
Just for the crack.
And, you know, they're kind of scattered to the four winds of the globe, and we should just maybe keep that notion parked for later on in our discussion. So we should go back then to the point in time where Dick James and Charles Silver decided to make a break from Northern Songs. You know what that means? It's time for a break.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. So it is the 28th of March, 1969. Dick James and Charles Silver, the owners, main owners of shares in Northern Songs, decide that it's time to sell up and go home. And it's a bit of a free-for-all. There is no agreement in place that says somebody gets first refusal or anybody, you know, is allowed to make a bid before anybody else.
This is a big problem. And it's difficult to see why there wasn't a shareholders agreement between all of the parties that basically said if one person wants to sell, they have to offer the shares to their co-shareholders, you know, that right of first refusal. And, you know, again, I think when the company is set up back in 1963, there is a naivety there. Somebody should have been looking out for the Beatles. Brian was obviously slightly out of his depth. What I would say is this is the type of publishing contract that Dick James had with the Beatles, that Elton John had with Dick James, and he would subsequently get his contract voided by the courts just for that very reason, that there was no independent advice. But yeah, I mean, any lawyer worth his salt in 1963 or today would be saying there needs to be a shareholders agreement and a right of first refusal. The question arises, why did Dick James decide to sell? He was making money. You know, the White Album was bringing in the cash. He was making money. So why did he decide to sell?
Well, we see Dick James, as you say, in Get Back, and he looks like he's travelled from a portal from, you know, 5 years earlier just to visit them in Twickenham. And, you know, he might have a sense of what the group is like at that point in time and what the vibe is like in Twickenham. But, you know, he might sort of feel, he might have gotten a sense, well, this is end days and the gravy train has to end somewhere. And he didn't have the farsightedness to go along with it. But maybe he was just trying to avoid Alan Klein and just get out of Dodge before Klein came after him.
This is very true. So I think, yeah, he also knew that the relations between Paul and John weren't great. He would not have, in the same way as Harold Pinsker stepped aside when John took his clothes off. You know, the Beatles are behaving very strangely. So there's that aspect. But I think the real thing is the arrival of Klein on the scene. It happens so fast after Klein gets involved. And Dick James is obviously aware of Klein's involvement. And there's a biography of Klein by a chap called Fred Goodman. And he specifically says when Klein started working with the Beatles, it could only mean the beginning of the end for Dick James.
Yes, and Dick James...
He does not want to be on the end of a Klein audit, that's basically...
No, and Dick James does have a, you know, he's a very successful businessman, he's got a keen antenna, and, you know, I think himself and Brian were definitely simpatico together in terms of what they managed to achieve, and things have been a little bit adrift for 19 months, and now he sees which way the wind is blowing, and, yeah, you know, it mightn't have been worth the trouble at that point, you know?
It's old school versus, you know, what the Beatles are doing. And I found a quote from Derek Taylor, because Derek Taylor was a witness to Dick James coming in and speaking to Neil Aspinall to let him know on the 20th of March that this was happening. And George Harrison is there. And Derek Taylor says, you know, he just thought, oh, this would be interesting. You know, can I sit in? So we have an eyewitness account, and he said George told Dick that the trouble was that Dick didn't really believe in John and Paul. Dick said that was a cruel, wicked thing to say, and I said the truth sometimes sounded cruel and wicked, which is a very righteous and pompous thing to say, but I said it was. And Dick said, when your opinion is needed, I will ask for it. I have come here to talk to Neil about private business concerning something very serious to me. Fucking serious to John and Paul, said George. Dick never liked rows with the Beatles, and I cannot blame him. He turned to Neil and said, the boys have come under the influence of some very bad advisors recently, and I'm not talking about you, Neil. I guess we all wondered what this dark hint meant. Was it Klein, or was it those predators, or was it really us, the Apple clique with our crazy attitudes towards business, the let it be, it'll all be okay amateurs?
Yeah, it's very sweet of George to, you know, be keeping an eye out for John and Paul at that point, because this is the end of March. And the thing you said a minute ago is there's so much other stuff happening at this point. Like, we've already done two episodes on the Ballad of John and Yoko, where we try and outline all the things that they do in that time and put it in song. And at that time, John and Yoko are in bed in Amsterdam, only trying to get us some peace. And, you know, while we see that time as them being in bed and talking to the press, the word gets through to them immediately that this has happened, and they get on the blower to Alan Klein. And Paul is off on his honeymoon in the US, and word gets through to him, and he gets on the phone separately to Alan Klein, amazingly.
So, separately, John and Paul both contact Klein, who is on holiday in Puerto Rico. Now, interestingly, John doesn't fly back to London. He goes to Vienna. You know,
well, he had to eat some chocolate cake in a bag.
But by the 2nd of April, everybody is back in London, and John and Paul and Alan, John, Paul, Alan, George and Ringo, John, Paul and Alan visit the bank, and they basically put together a counter bid for 1 million shares at £2.13 per share, which sort of shows you the price has risen from 39p in 1965 to 185 is what the ATV bid, the Lou Grade bid, is sitting there with Dick James. Alan Klein only needs 1 million shares to get control of the company, so he can go slightly higher, and he pushes the price up to £2.13.
Yeah, so we should say there is a bid in place from ATV Music, which is Lou Grade, and they want to buy all the shares at 185 a share.
What has happened is Dick James and Charles Silver have agreed to sell their shares, and ATV has basically put out a bid to say we will buy all of the shares in the company, including the Beatles and everybody else. We'll buy them all at £1.85. Client's counteroffer is we will buy 1 million shares at £2.13. And on that same day, Dick James goes to Paul's house at Cavendish Avenue and meets with John, Paul and Klein. And he is, by all accounts, completely unrepentant. You know, it's just business. This is a nice little earner for you guys. You know, sell your shares. You'll still have your income from the shares. So we should point out at this stage, losing the shares and losing the company doesn't mean they lose the income from the songs. So the song income is being split 50-50 between Northern Songs and on the one hand and John and Paul on the other.
Yes, they get a songwriter. So you know, maybe you all know this already, but the publishing company, its role is to administer the songwriting, the songs themselves, and the songwriters still get money, and a good publishing company will increase the sum of money for the songwriter and keep a share of the money for itself. So even through to 21st century, when we get into the realm, and it's not going to be covered in this podcast, of Michael Jackson and everybody else owning Beatles songs, throughout all that time, you know, Paul McCartney and John Lennon, the estate of John Lennon, are making the songwriter money off the Lennon and McCartney songbook, but they are not making any publishing money, and publishing is also where the control is, which is why we have Beatles songs in commercials, but not Beatles recordings in commercials. That's reasonably clear, isn't it?
I think so. So Dick James comments that Paul was annoyed, but John was inconsolable. Yeah. And again, I think that's an interesting distinction. You know, Paul, they're both upset. Paul is annoyed, but John is just completely devastated by this. And that probably, you know, the songs are his art. He's now with Yoko. She's, you know, increasing his sense of being an artist and his own sort of sense of the value of what he's doing. So keep that in mind. Keep John's state of mind foremost whenever we kind of carry on. But as you say, things just are still happening in the background.
They are still happening. John and Yoko are on telly with Eamon Andrews. And so this does dovetail with our Ballad of John and Yoko episode. And they have to... They're also doing photo shoots. That famous photo shoot of them on the boat in the lake and at the row and in the Rolls Royce and all the rest.
Yep.
happens that week as well, on the 9th of April. They have to reject the ATV offer because ATV are going after the shares that John and Paul own. So they formally reject the ATV offer on the 10th of April. Yep. And, you know, the same week, that weekend, it's the thing we mentioned in our last episode, which is the Sunday Times article saying Alan Klein is a dreadful toe rag and shouldn't be trusted and he's an awful man. And who knows why that story was there.
Well, that was, we know, we mentioned the last time, this is Leonard Reichenberg has, because again, while this is happening, the Triumph Investments NEM story is, you know, there's court proceedings and that's still rumbling along in the background as well. Then on the 14th of April, they record Ballad of John and Yoko.
It's so funny. Like that day that Sunday Times story is in place is the day, as far as we know, that John goes over to Cavendish Avenue with the Ballad of John and Yoko. And Paul goes, yeah, let's record it tomorrow and let's put it out as a single. And then later that week, they record Old Brown Shoe. So it's remarkable that they're, all of that is going on. And then they, you know, I have this theory that even in the modern day, that the reason McCartney still goes on tour is that when he's performing and when he's on stage, it's the one time when he doesn't actually have to think about being Paul McCartney, that somebody's going to annoy him or talk to him, that it's a zen place, even though it's a very public place. And I guess that's the same, that they can just go into a studio and record. They don't, that's something that nobody else can really be involved in.
Yes, it takes them someplace else.
Yeah.
Away from sort of the business hassles. And They agree on that 16th of April session for Old Brown Shoe. They sort of agree a timetable for five more recording sessions in April. So this is still the hangover from the Get Back sessions. You know, they're still doing bits and pieces without any real particular aim. You know, they haven't got to the stage yet where they're focused on, oh, will we do an album and it will be Abbey Road. Then we get to, I'm just checking, this is Liberty Bell Day, I think.
Well, now, Liberty Bell Day is famously, as we said at the start, this date in May, but...
No. It's this date in... It's the date in April.
Right. There's Stephen's Liberty Bell Day and Jason's Liberty Bell Day. So, yes. If you don't know what we're talking about, Paul McCartney often refers to the day that Alan Klein forced his name on the signature as the day there was a crack in the Liberty Bell, that there was a crack in the Beatles, because it had reached that point, and that's the date at the start of May where we started. But actually... You know, heaven forbid you should be a contrarian, Stephen. You think that the Liberty Bell Day is... Well, we're not exactly sure of the date, but it's in the slipstream of the old brown shoe sessions. It's in the following days.
Yes, I think it must be the 17th. There are sources that variously say the 17th or 18th, and Barry Miles will say the 20th. But because of a letter that is written and dated on the 18th, I think it must be... the 17th, and I do genuinely think that this is a bigger or more consequential happening.
Well, what happens on this day is it's bigger than Klein versus a Beatle. It's actually Beatle versus Beatle, or it's yes. John and Paul. So talk us through what happens.
Well, what has happened is they put this bid together, and to fund the counter offer, Apple is going to put up half the money, they're going to put up £1 million. EMI is going to lend them money, or they're going to borrow money, another million. And they've got to put up some kind of collateral for this. So, you know, security, EMI want some security. And so they all get together. All the Beatles are there. Peter Brown is there. And they start totting up how many shares have we got, what's the value of the shares, and then we're going to put these shares up for collateral. And Paul, in the course of this, it comes out that he's saying, I'm not going to put my shares up. I'm not going to put them up for collateral. They're not available. So you needn't bother including my shares in this total. Now, this makes no sense to me whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the deal. They've all come together to do this. The Eastmans are supposedly saying to him, it's a bit risky. You don't want to put your shares up. If you default on the loan, then you'll lose your shares, and EMI will get your shares. But the downside is, if you don't put your shares up, we're not going to be able to afford to take this this deal.
Somebody's going to come and take them off you.
Yeah. So I don't understand that. So there are two consequences from this. One, Klein rides in to the rescue, and he says, well, okay, I have shares in MGM worth £650,000. I will put those shares up as collateral. And this is an easy win for Klein. Mm. You know, Paul has already made himself look bad. Klein seizes the opportunity and says, well, I am the white knight. I'm coming in. I will put my assets on the line. He still doesn't have a contract at this stage. Now,
yeah, but he's you know what he's up to. You know what he's doing.
Exactly. He is inserting himself financially into the affairs of the Beatles. But it's a ridiculously easy win that is handed to him on a plate, because Paul and or the Eastmans is saying, we're not going to do this because it's too risky. Why is it too risky? These are your shares, your songs. The value of the shares is dependent on your ability to write songs.
Well, here comes the second part of all of this, though, which is the truth.
Then there is the second part. So that's the context for this. Then Klein casually drops into the conversation, presumably, but in the course of totting up the shares, it comes out that Paul has more shares than John.
Yeah. Seems totally fine.
We have to be very careful about sort of the emotive language. And you read lots of different books, and they say Paul was secretly buying up shares, and there's a kind of pejorative term, secretly. But he was using Peter Brown to go and buy these shares. Yeah. And he wasn't telling anybody that he was doing it. And he was definitely putting himself into a position where he was technically earning more money from the songs than was his co-writing partner, John. There's no reason why he shouldn't be buying shares.
Anyone could buy the shares. That's what public company means. And so he wasn't, the reason why he had more shares wasn't that he was given more shares. It was just he was investing in himself. He was, you know, companies do share buyback programs. And he just thought, well, he realized the importance of it. And, you know, without telling anyone, totally normal, he had managed to pick up some extra shares. So if we look at the numbers.
The numbers are very, it's very, very difficult. I find it very difficult. I mean, I've read nearly two books. I've read about half a dozen or more sources.
Two books on this, not just two books in your life. That's
what two books in my life. I've read quite a lot of books and articles. There seems to be a general agreement that on that day, Paul was sitting with 751,000 shares. So assuming he had 750,000 to begin with, that isn't a big increase. Most sources seem to say that John had about 644,000, 650,000. And then you've got to think, well, what happened to his 100,000? Maybe they went into a trust for Julian as part of the divorce settlement.
Yeah.
And John was holding them as a trustee. And it doesn't really matter if they were in a trust or not. If he was holding them as a trustee, he probably had the ability to deal with them. Cynthia talks more about there being 100,000 in cash in the trust fund, and this was a trust fund that he put up for Julian with the caveat that Julian had to share that trust fund with any future children of John's.
Right.
So there's a little bit of this difficulty pinning down the precise numbers, but what I would say is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether Paul had 100,000 more than John or 1,000 more than John. This is a question of trust, and it's the principle, and it doesn't matter how many more he had, it's the fact that he went out and he says, I had some beanies and I wanted more.
Well, that's a quote from many years from now, so that's a very much a retrospective quote.
He still thinks it's okay. He's still saying, I don't understand, you know, I'm fine. You could have bought the shares, I could have bought the shares, but if I suddenly bought, you know, if you suddenly discovered that I owned 55% of Nothing Is Real.
What?
And I...
55% of nothing is still nothing.
Is still nothing.
Brand awareness, obviously.
You would not be happy.
Well, but it is odd that this story is constantly parroted as Paul went out and bought loads of shares. And the truth of the story seems to be Paul went out and bought a very small number of shares, increasing his holding by less than 1%, by basically 0.3%. He increased the number of shares he had, and John somehow 100,000 shares disappeared. Because we're told in 65 that John has 750,000 shares, yet by 69 he's only got around 650,000 shares. So the majority of the discrepancy, a hundredfold of that discrepancy, is because John has let shares go.
But I think we're assuming. I don't know that John has let them go. I think we're assuming that he has put.
They've
shares
changed
into
form, into a, some kind of financial form.
Into a trust. But if Cynthia is saying there was a trust fund for £100,000, that would represent 50,000 shares, because the shares are valued at around £2. Somewhere between 185 and 213 is where the bids are sitting. So he would only have to put 50,000 into Julian's trust fund. So maybe the figure of 750,000 is not correct from 1965.
He might have set up the trust fund when they were only worth a pound each. We don't know the details of that. We are not forensic accountants, Stephen.
We are not forensic accountants. I think we would have to go back and unlock the sort of details of the flotation and the details. I have spent a long time trying to get to the bottom of how many shares people had in that room. And there's a book called Apple to the Core, and it was written in the early 1970s. It was reasonably close to the time. I'm thinking I'm going with them, which is, you know, 650,000 plus another 100,000 in a trust fund. And Paul had 751. So the discrepancy is probably only 1,000 shares. But again, I think the point for John is it doesn't matter whether it was one share, 1,000 shares or 100,000 shares. It's the principle that his partner that he trusted that they have this relationship. We talked about this, you know, that John thinks they're almost telepathic, you know, they don't need to communicate by using words. And suddenly he finds, and this is the point at which Peter Brown says they nearly came to blows. John was going to hit Paul. He's being, Klein at one point is holding him back.
He's calling him a bastard.
He's calling him a bastard. He's shaking his fist at Linda. The other aspect of this is it is badly received by John, or by John, but also by George and Ringo. Mm. So they all, the other three Beatles in the room, take this badly and regard this as being a breach of trust. And I don't think you can overstate the impact of that on the relationship between John and Paul. And Ken McNabb, who wrote a very good book, and in the end, he says this was the day the trust died between John Lennon and Paul McCartney. So I'm calling this meeting as Liberty Bell Day. This is when the trust leaves. And the immediate consequence of this is that John, George and Ringo write a letter to the Eastmans saying, that's it, your retainer is terminated.
It's very much a, there's definitely a before and after to this meeting, isn't there? There's you know, everything leading up to it and everything after. Ringo still has about 40,000 shares. George sold his shares, apparently, his 40,000.
That is really interesting.
Yeah.
Particularly when you regard, if you remember George, do you want to come and see what shares? No. And get back. He's not interested. He doesn't want to engage with Dick James at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, in 1964, I think George formed a company called Morn York or something, and then it became Harrisong. So as soon as his 3 years was up with Northern Songs, he went off, and all his publishing is then Harrisong.
Yeah.
And interestingly, he got a better deal from Northern Songs than John and Paul. They got a 50-50 split. He got an 80-20 split in his favour from Northern Songs.
It's a wonder Ringo didn't go in with his 40,000 shares and said, wait, I thought we all had 40,000 shares. That would have been funny.
This is the point at which there's a fundamental change, because what has happened in this meeting is Paul has chosen the Eastmans. He is taking their advice on not putting things up. The other three have terminated the Eastmans' appointment. This is where the two camps are separate. And I think this is the big split.
Well, it also informs the actual Liberty Bell Day just over 2 weeks later. But there is still work to be done. So if we're looking at kind of the sequence of events, you know, John, a few days later, changes his name. John Ono Lennon happens that week. So he's really going all in on this Yoko lady. I think that's fair to say.
I think that's fair to say. They do that on the roof of Savile Row.
And then there's this NEMS Triumph business that we mentioned in the last episode is also happening simultaneously at this time. So that dispute gets rectified on the 24th of April. And they are still recording music at the end of April, although it's kind of in a bit of a solo vibe. Paul is doing vocal overdubs on Oh Darling on the 26th. Ringo is doing vocal overdubs on Octopus's Garden on the 29th. And it's being reported in the news that Klein will sit on the board of a restructured Northern Songs if the Beatles get to take it over.
Yes, because what has happened is some of the shares that the sort of floating around in third-party ownership, they are now in play, and the Beatles are trying to reassure people, you know, existing shareholders that, you know, it won't be Klein, will be running this company. This becomes an issue. Will Northern Songs have an independent management? So they're having to make this kind of public statement to say, well, if we win, Klein will not be running Northern Song.
And what's really striking is that there's this kind of big schism between John and Paul on this date. And, you know, they're never going to get back into the studio and record together again or do anything of any huge significance. Wait a sec, what's this? 30th of April, 1969. What are they doing?
This is their recording. You know my name, look up the number. So 12 days after the big row. So, you know, we did an entire episode on this. And honestly, if I sit down and think about this, I actually do think get quite emotional about this. I think this it's a kind of jokey throwaway song, but when you know the background and you know the context, and we said it on that episode, but they are the two of them standing around a microphone trying to reach back into that, trying to recapture that teenage listening to the Goons, that kind of relationship that they had, and it's just out of reach. And I think it's completely understandable that Paul says this is, you know, in the Sessions book, that this is his favourite song.
When we did our You Know My Name, Look Up the Number episode, I didn't really appreciate just how close it was to all of this goings on. It's at the end of that month of April, and so much has happened. Ballad of John and Yoko has come into existence. There's this fight for the soul of the actual songs themselves in Northern Songs. John and Paul are, you know, really the worst thing that has ever potentially happened to their relationship. Certainly the worst thing in the post-Brian era. And now they are recording You Know My Name, Look Up the Number on the last day of April.
Yeah, I mean, 12 days before, John was having to be physically restrained from punching Paul.
Yeah. But, you know, John and Paul, in kind of totally different ways, are great compartmentalizers, you know? Yeah. I certainly think that Paul, and, you know, you see it through modern day Paul, he's a great compartmentalizer in the face that he's got a, you know, public-facing Paul, private-facing Paul, family Paul, MPL Paul. He can really tie up all these things and just, you know, do them all separately and independently. And in a different way, John is also maybe, without going to amateur psychologist hour, but a bit of an emotional compartmentalizer. He's able to be angry, and then when the anger is over, he's able to go do something else and able to be loving and able to be kind of clear and forthright. And, you know, he kind of has this thing where, his, you know, the anger is an honesty, you know, but you just have to be honest to your feelings in the moment. And that's another form of compartmentalization. So there's a way that that suits the two of them, that suits each other for them to be that way.
And John consoled himself by buying Tittenhurst.
Well, that's, the madness still continues, because we're trying to...
No need to stop spending.
We're trying to work towards the 9th of May, which is this kind of Liberty Bell Day. But the first week in May is still bonkers. So they record Something, you know, just a little ditty called Something.
Yep.
And John and Yoko buy Tittenhurst, and the Get Back single comes out. So John and Yoko, they buy Tittenhurst, and... yeah, that's a wise financial move.
It's great, because then they start putting their illegal lake in and refurbing it. Because if you remember that we mentioned, I think, on the Hey Jude LP special Acast Plus bonus episode, which everybody should be subscribing to, you know, they don't move in until mid-August. So they're getting, they have to spend more money getting it ready to move into. Because, you know, I don't know about you, but if I buy a house, I never move in until I've built an illegal lake.
Well, I think so it's a busy first week. I think I said Get Back single was released. It actually hits the top of the charts at the start of May. It's number one. It comes out earlier in April, but there's still, and the presses are being reared up for the Ballad of John and Yoko, and they're working on You Never Give Me Your Number at Olympic Studio. So they're still able to keep their calendars in order, get together when they need to get together. But You Never Give Me Your Money, to actually realise that it's being recorded on the 6th of May is a bit poignant, considering now the surrounding time.
Yeah, and Paul makes the point, this is about Klein. He says in Many Years From Now, this was me directly lambasting Alan Klein's attitude to us. No money, just funny paper. All promises and it never works out. It's basically a song about no faith in the person that found its way into the medley on Abbey Road. John saw the humour in it. I'd bet.
Is it a funny song? It's certainly poignant. I've never really, you know, obviously, you know, we all love the Abbey Road medley and it's a lovely melodic song, but it's, yeah, it is kind of tragic, you know, to think that that's where he was at. And that's how it comes out in him.
Yeah, and he says the same thing about Carry That Weight, that it's just that the burden of all of these things were sort of getting to him, that he tries to be upbeat. He's an upbeat kind of person, but there's sometimes it just, you can't. And that it is a very kind of wistful song. And it's, you know, he says, oh, it's about me directly lambasting Alan Klein. He's not lambasting anybody. It's a very maybe I'm projecting, but it's more regretful than anger. It's not that he's lambasting anybody. He's just, it's almost, it's regret, or at least that's in the context of the medley. I think that's what comes
across.
That's
how it feels. You Never Give Me Your Money is recorded on the 6th of May. 7th of May, John with Yoko, Paul and George and Klein and their lawyers, they meet to discuss this ongoing issue that we mentioned in the last episode of the Triumph deal and NEMS and frozen royalties and where they need to go and how that's all going to be arranged. And Ringo then arrives after lunch, good old Ringo, and Klein leaves the room and the four of them are together and they're discussing the details or the terms of Klein's appointment. And you know, Pete Doggett has documented that, you know, no one's querying Klein's appointment, but, you know, Paul is being Paul about it. And it's still this issue of Klein wants something signed.
Yes. So Klein has been on the scene basically since, you know, the last days of January. He has been involved in the NEMS situation. He's squaring them through the Northern Songs litigation. And bear in mind that independently, Paul and John each ring Klein, who's, as I working without a contract. The Beatles are then in the room discussing this. Their lawyers are present in the room. So it's not just the four of them and Yoko. It's the four of them, Yoko, and their lawyers. Pete Doggett, as you say, is making the point. No one is saying we're not appointing Klein. No one is even querying the terms, the 20% that he's to get, which will become a sticking point. But this is not being queried. So Paul has brought his own lawyer along, and but this is not being queried. They're just hammering out the details of the contract. And then the next day, on the 8th of May, the lawyers start shuffling around, working on the drafts, and start collecting signatures.
Yeah, so they want to try and basically get signatures in order to have a binding agreement with John Paul, George Ringo, and Alan Klein. So they have the meeting on the 7th, which is a Wednesday. The Thursday is the 8th of May, and the lawyers, essentially this chap, Peter Howard, is getting these things signed. So who signs first?
So Peter Howard gets John's signature first, and then he drives off to Esher to get George's signature. And at this point, the whole thing descends into a Joe Orton farce, but without the group sex and cross-dressing. John shows his copy of the document to Klein, who says, this isn't good. It says it's not binding. John says, yeah, can see what you mean. He calls George, you know, no more mobile phone. So he calls George and said, yeah, this should be changed back into a binding document. You can let the lawyer know when he gets with you.
Yeah.
Fine. The lawyer arrives with George, only to discover he hadn't actually brought the document with him. He had brought a carbon copy. So he gets the carbon copy and he makes a manuscript amendment to make it absolutely binding. George signs it. But before he signs it, George thinks, I'd better call Paul.
Mm.
But he can't get him because Paul has changed his phone number.
Totally normal behavior.
And has not given anybody his new number. Now, there's something fantastically passive aggressive about that. That you just, you know, it's like ghosting somebody. It's just, so Paul.
He ghosted the Beatles. Love it.
Yeah. I never give you my number.
Yeah, pretty much. That's what he was talking about. He got an idea while he was recording the songs.
So George tries to let Paul know that this is happening, but can't get him. So then George signs it, the carbon, with handwritten amendments. The lawyer drives to Ringo, who signs it. The lawyer then goes back to John to get him to re-sign the actual carbon. So there are now three signatures on a carbon copy that has had manuscript amendments to it. But this needs Paul's signature, and it will even then not be binding until it is formally ratified at a board meeting of Apple. But no one can contact Paul.
Well, it's still a good day's work for that lawyer to get three signatures on a piece of paper, three signatures from the most famous men in the world. So, you know, agreeing to 20% for Alan Klein. So, you know, it's he might as well just sleep on it. And the next day, the 9th of May, Friday, he can go off and get Paul's signature and everything will work out somehow.
I thought you were going to say he can get up in the morning and he can rush out and buy Zapple 1 and Zapple 2, which are released on the 9th of May.
Yes, harbingers of doom, perhaps.
Electronic sound and unfinished music, Life with the Lions.
So this carbon copy is then headed towards Olympic Studios to get Paul to sign it.
Yes.
But that is where we are going to press pause. Again, we have made it to the 9th of May without seeing the sun go down on it. So we have taken two roads to the one day to get Paul to sign a contract on Friday, the 9th of May, to put in writing what Alan Klein has wanted in writing since the end of January 1969, which is yes. that he is the de facto business manager of the Beatles.
Everything is set fair. Everything is set fair.
What could possibly go wrong is the thing you might want to ask. So once again, in a sense of deja vu or Groundhog Day, we will take up the story next time round on the next. I mean, these episodes are obviously bigger than Alan Klein. I know we're labelling them as Alan Klein, but we are trying to piece together the story of how this man weaves his way through all the events in the lives of the four of them through this chunk of 1969. It's unlike anything the four of them have experienced before, and they've experienced a lot of things in the previous couple of years, and this is a totally new world.
Let us be clear, nothing is bigger than Alan Klein.
So 9th of May 1969, that's where we will start the next time. We remain available in all the usual places.
tune in next week.
Tune in next week when we look at it from another point of view. This is like the Rashomon of podcasts. We remain available in all the usual places on the interweb at nothingisrealpod.com, the Twitter account at BeatlesPod, which is me, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, which is Stephen. There's the Instagram, which is William. There's the TikTok, which doesn't really happen, and all the other fun things. We have lots of fun stuff on the website. We have our Acast Plus supporters episodes, and we've put out some enjoyable ones so far this year. We've got Tops and Tails extra episodes for our Hey Jude episodes, for instance, looking at John and Cynthia and the Hey Jude album as well. We want to thank all our Acast Plus supporters, and you might want to check out the selection that we have available there. And I think that's everything that that we need to mention, isn't it?
I think so. I can hardly wait to find out what happens next.
It's not good. Anyway, for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.